It was an April morning. The windy day was dawning. We combed our hair and brushed our teeth and set sail from the waters of Leith.
Unfeasibly soon, while the sun stood at noon, we came to a blue lagoon. What a brilliant isle! Let's tarry a while and read books by the light of the moon.
Welcome to the Island of Brilliant,
the podcast that treasures everything that's brilliant about children's books.
Then good luck came knocking at my door. Skies are grey, but they're not grey anymore.
Frank, how are you doing?
I'm all right.
That didn't sound okay. That sounded a bit weak and a bit feeble.
I've got 60,000 steps on my step counter.
Really, have you?
I've been doing a lot of walking, yeah.
I have noticed that. You've been circling the island a lot.
Pounding the edge, searching the horizon.
Doing that funny power walk where you wiggle your hips a bit too much and it looks strange. I've been trying not to look, Frank, but it's been distracting you trying to power walk around the island.
And how are you, Nadia Shireen?
I'm not bad, thanks. I've decided to take up coffee.
Oh.
Yeah, new thing. Because, you know, 45 years I've just been doing tea. Coffee's always sent me a bit funny. So I've been using the Island of Brilliant cafetiere. Because the coffee beans they have here are insane.
Yeah. I mean, the cafetiere is available to you because, as you know, I've given up tea and coffee for Lent. And the smell of your cafetiere is fortifying my spiritual resistance.
Oh, okay. See, that's a nice way to look at it. Because I'm not as nice as you. I would have been saying, oh, stop it, because the smell's really annoying me. But this just shows what a good person you are. You're like, oh, it's fortifying me.
It's been a voyage of discovery, and I've discovered that what I thought was my perky personality is actually just a reaction to caffeine.
It's just caffeine, yeah.
Without caffeine, yeah, I don't actually have a personality.
I didn't want to say.
You did want to say.
All right, I did want to say, but you said it yourself. Frank, it feels like a long time since we last checked in. Tell me, have you moved on from the book you were reading last time we spoke? Are you reading something new? What's going on in your reading life?
So last time we spoke, I was reading Drop of Golden Sun by Kate Saunders.
You were.
Which is about the making of a movie. Then we interviewed Christopher Edge about the Black Hole Cinema Club. And so I'm reading books about movies, and I'm now reading Movies Showing Nowhere by Jorik Gurdvik, which is a book in translation. It's brilliantly translated by Laura Watkinson, who also translated, do you remember Letter from the King? That was a big hit. And Lampy.
No.
She's a really brilliant translator. So this is from the Dutch. A Movie Showing Nowhere. It's really interesting. It's about a little girl who she's sort of lost everybody in her life. And she comes across a mysterious cinema, which it restores memories. It gives you new memories.
Oh, gosh.
Or memories that you've lost, or gives you back things you've forgotten. Isn't that a wonderful, wonderful concept?
So are they real memories? So they're memories of things that actually happened, or are they invented?
Yeah, it's a really interesting book about memory because I don't know if you have this, but like sometimes I think I remember things and realise that I couldn't possibly remember that. That memory's been implanted by family history or something like that. So it's sort of on the edge of all that stuff, and it's really good. It's beautiful. It's really thoughtful. But it's also got that kind of lovely light tone. You know, the chapter headings themselves are just really funny. One of the chapters is called All the Sad Sacks in the World, Stiff and Stinky, Kate's Dad, Are You a Coward, Stupid Drivel on TV. That's the chapter that I'm reading at the moment, Stupid Drivel on TV. So it's really, really good. It's by Pushkin Press, who are doing tons of work bringing books from other countries into our lives. So I really recommend it.
What kind of vague, I mean, I know this is always a tricky one, but what kind of vague age group is this?
It's a chapter book, so key stage two maybe. It's not heavily illustrated. Chapters are very short. Yeah, it's like, say, King of the Copper Mountain, that kind of book. You know, or we talked about Glow Rushes the other week. You know, it's got a lot of ideas. Yeah. it's lovely. I love it.
Oh, that sounds fab.
And I'm also reading, and you tell me what you think about this.
Go on.
I'm reading a P.G. Woodhouse book that I've not read before.
Okay.
I'm thinking about, how old were you when you first read P.G. Woodhouse?
I was very young, not to sound... They weren't my books. They belonged to other people in the house.
Yeah.
Well, I say very young. I mean, I don't know. I was like 8 or 9, maybe?
See, I would never have read those books as a kid. And one of my children got into them. And I got into them through one of my children. Mm. And I think we should, like... They're brilliant. They're so funny.
Yeah, they are.
They're so light. They're so acrobatic. They're set in a complete fantasy world. I'm reading Laughing Gas.
Yeah.
Which is about, you know, the two guys go to have their teeth out and they swap souls while they're under the gas.
I've not read that
so
one, actually.
Fun. And it's set in Hollywood. And I was thinking that we should talk a bit more about grown-up books that kids might like.
Yeah, that's...
Because just
that's...
the pure level of fun and linguistic fireworks that are in... And the innocence in P.G. Woodhouse. They're all supposed to be adults, but they all act like children.
Because I have an argument with a friend about P.G. Woodhouse. Because... I often say what a huge influence P.G. Woodhouse is on me. Really formative. And that, and my friend is like, well, you know, I hate, you know, I don't want to read about the English rule in class being, you know, statty. And I'm like, well, I guess I just never came to it with that baggage, because for me it was just all fantasy land. Like you say, the people were ridiculous. So I didn't take it seriously. And the language is just a joy. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I just pick up a P.G. Woodhouse, any P.G. Woodhouse book, and open it at any page if I just want to lift and read a few paragraphs.
To me, it's the gold standard of being funny. And you can feel how much work has gone into making that look effortless. The amount of heavy lifting he did to make it weightless.
Yeah, absolutely, you know? Right. Absolutely right. Every sentence has been so well crafted, but it just... flows, like you say, it's light as a feather.
If I listed my 10 favourite sentences in the world, I think 9 of them would be from Blandings or somewhere, you know.
Anyway, going to talk about me now. I have been enjoying a book. It came out about 3 years ago, and I don't know where I've been that I've missed this. It's called Einstein the Penguin. You familiar with this, Fran?
Oh, no. But no, that's a great title.
Do excuse my pronunciation. I think it's Iona Rangeley, and it's illustrated by David Tasman, who some of you might know. David Tasman is the illustrator of, amongst other things, the Mr. Gum books by Andy Stanton.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And he also illustrated a great picture book called Don't Let the Elephant Drive the Bus. But anyway, Einstein the Penguin, it's just so funny and delightful. And it's about a family who go to the zoo one day. There's one penguin who just stares very insistently at them and kind of waves. And the kids are like, Mom, Dad, this penguin wants to come home with us. And the parents obviously are like, don't be ridiculous. And they drag the children and they go back home on the bus. And then later that evening, the lasagna's in the oven and the kids are playing a jigsaw and arguing. And there's a knock at the door. And the dad opens the door and it's a penguin with an orange rucksack who's come to stay, who can't speak. Brilliant. But... you know, they say, well, Mum, you did say come and visit any time. And they were like, well, I guess we did. So the penguin waddles in and moves in. Really funny. I would say it's kind of 7 to 10 if we're going to have to give it an age. But it's just so beautifully written and just charming. It's got a kind of Paddington air to it. The boy, Arthur, smuggles the penguin into school. And the story is basically the kids trying to understand where Einstein has come from and what his mission is. And they help him. But it's just funny, charming, and also some really lyrical writing sneaking in here and there. And yeah, huge recommend.
I want that. Can I borrow it after you?
You can. Also, I wanted to quickly mention, because this pod comes out, if you're listening to it as it comes out, at the beginning of the Easter holidays. And I thought it might be quickly worth mentioning audiobooks, because car journeys, you what, good audiobook makes a world of difference. So I just wanted to quickly mention a couple of faves from Shireen's car, which are Cresta Cowell's How to Train Your Dragon series, as read by David Tennant. Fantastic.
Yeah.
And also Pamela Butchart's books.
Yes.
There's a Werewolf in My Tent. Her baby, I think they're called the Baby Alien series. Yeah. So we've been listening to them a lot, and I think they're read by Susan Kalman. They are great, two great series, but enhanced by two fantastic readers. And if we're going to make that a neat three, then I'll plug Grimwood, only because Adam Buxton does the reads those, and he adds all sorts of bells and whistles.
You can't go wrong with Martin Jarvis reading Just Will You. That's the Sistine Chapel of audiobooks, I think.
Really? Okay.
Really? You've not heard that?
I've not heard it.
It's extraordinary. It's so funny. Since we're allowed to do this, I feel shy saying this, but my book Framed, the audiobook by Jason Hughes, is just beautiful. It's so good. And I listen to it and think, I can't believe that I'm involved in this.
Aww.
He just does such a great job of it.
That is a funny thing about a really good audiobook, is that, you kind of go...
It's transformative.
It is transformative. And obviously, see, I think the gold standard's Alan Bennett doing The Wind and the Willows. That's pretty great.
Yeah, no, that is good. But honestly, Martin Jarvis doing one of William's rants, it's just very, very special thing.
Well, I'll check it out.
Of course, we're not going on any car journeys because we're stuck on an island.
I know, I glossed over that. Listen, while I'm here, Fran, let me just warn you. I've noticed, this is a bit dark, I've noticed a few limbs have washed ashore. I think the sharks are back. I don't want to... It's fine. It just means lay off the swimming, because I've noticed just the odd arm and leg just kind of drifting up, and I've buried them immediately, but it's a sure sign we should steer clear of the water.
So what I thought was a kind of mid-morning sunset was actually just
bloodbath,
spillage.
Total bloodbath. Absolute carnage. That said, Frank, even though we've now got shark-infested waters, I did throw my frisbee a bit too far, and it is bobbing on the surface of the sea. Could you be a dear and go in and get it for me?
You know that I'm going to say yes.
Please.
And I'll go
thank
do that.
You.
I'm going to dive in.
Thanks, Frank. You're the best. There he goes.
And I'm going to skim it back to you.
All right. Well, keep going. Further out, further out. You've got to get about waist high. Keep going.
I can't see a frisbee.
Listeners.
Oh, God. Is this it?
This might be the end of celebrated author and playwright Frank Cottrell Boyce. I can see some thrashing. There's some terrible thrashing going on out there. You all right, Frank?
I'm okay? Thank you.
Is
this the right frisbee?
Are you wrestling with a shark?
Yeah, but don't worry about your frisbee. I've got the shark.
Drag it ashore, Frank. Drag the shark.
There's someone on the shark.
Are you El McNichol?
Yes, hi, and hello from my shark.
I'm so sorry about this. This is so embarrassing.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't know bringing the shark this way on the island would cause so much.
It's
so
absolutely
much stress.
Fine. Is the shark okay? Should we quickly turn it round and plonk it back
in
the sea?
Oh, she's fine.
Is she okay?
She loves the shallows.
All right.
She's
all
great.
Oh, well, come ashore. Thank
Does you. Anyone want this frisbee then?
Oh, sorry, Fran. I'd forgotten that you existed. Yeah, come on. You okay? Are you all right?
I'm all right. Yeah.
Oh, this isn't my frisbee. This is a different frisbee. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Thanks, I guess. Sorry, Elle. Anyway, Elle, sit down. It's a thrill to have you on the Island of Brilliant.
Thank you.
You are something of a superstar. I'm sure listeners will know your books, but in case they need their memories jogged, you've written A Kind of Spark, Show Us Who You Are, Like a Charm, and we've got Keedy coming very soon. Is that right?
Yeah, very soon, on the 4th of April.
And are we allowed to talk about a brilliant thing that happened to you last night relating to your first book, A Kind of Spark, which was turned into a TV show? What happened last night? Tell us.
Well, before jumping on the shark, we won an award for Best Children's Programme, and it was very, very overwhelming, and I just wish there had been more children's publishing people in the room, because it was very scary TV people.
You should say what the award was, because it's not a small award.
Royal Television Society Awards.
That is a proper award.
That's a proper award. Did you have a great night?
It was lovely, and we were the only people there representing children's things, so it was really, really nice.
Amazing work.
Did you make a speech?
No, we didn't make a speech because we were told we weren't important enough to make a speech.
Wow.
So we took the award, we smiled, and we ran off stage.
That's so funny. But also, not true. You are so important enough to make a speech. And I think it's brilliant, because A Kind of Spark that's the book that's changed your life, maybe?
Yeah, definitely. I think the first book you ever published is quite life-changing, but that one definitely, it's definitely the one I hear about the most.
Didn't it win like the Waterstones Prize and it won the Blue Peter Book Award? Like, it landed with such a splash. It was amazing.
No, it was. We were very lucky. It was a very good first book, and I'm proud of it. And yeah, and Kidi is the prequel. It's the same world.
I mean, what made you decide to revisit Juniper? And
I think I was always, not to bore people with publishing details, but when the first book was written, it was what is called a two-book deal, and the second book I always intended to be the same characters, so Addy and Kidi and Nina and everyone in the town of Juniper. Then as I was writing, COVID started, and it just felt that they didn't work together, so I put it aside. And it wasn't until we were filming season one of the show for BBC iPlayer and walking around a built set of the town and watching characters walk about in costume that I felt, oh, I would quite like to go back now that all these people are acting it out in front of me, which is a strange sensation. And I felt ready to go back. And it's a character. This is a character that is in A Kind of Spark, but this is their first time as the narrator. And it's a character that I get the most letters about and the most messages about from young people. So I thought it would be nice if she had her own story.
Do you feel sometimes it's not necessarily the right thing to just boom, do the next book in that story? Like, it's nice for it to kind of filter through people's minds and your readership.
Oh, definitely. I think it's a much better book now than it would have been in March 2020. Anyway, if I can say that.
That must have been extraordinary to walk around the set, the physical world of your characters, while thinking about what to do with them next. So are they cast in your head now?
Not really. There's a couple who have taken over in my head. I think John, who plays Mr. McIntosh, who's like one of the more sort of curmudgeon-y townspeople, he sort of has taken over because he's such a Charlie Chaplin. He's so funny. And I think Caitlin, who played Nina, has taken over a little bit. But the rest are kind of separate. And it was strange. It felt, walking around the town built up from the ground up, it felt like a weird therapy exercise, sort of like the Truman Show. And everyone keeps coming up and putting a microphone in your face and going like, how does it feel? And you just like, I don't know how it feels. It's very strange.
That's a hard question, because how do you feel when it's happening to you right there and then? Like, there's not even time to process the feeling. It's like, I don't know, I'm just here.
Yeah, and there's someone doing, you know, the boom mic who just looks like they've been on their feet for 12 hours and they want to die. And you just think, well, it's not everyone's dream come true. Yeah, but the showrunner was never more than an inch away from my face, just sort of staring, waiting for some kind of reaction.
Really?
I don't know if I gave them what they wanted.
But you wrote some of the scripts as well, didn't you?
Yes, I wrote on all the episodes, and I wrote 2 and 9 by myself, and that was terrifying. And the same for season 2 as well.
So we're here really to talk about Kidi, which is the prequel to A Kind of Spark. And we should sort of tell people what Kind of Spark is about. Because it's got this very bold time scheme. It's a wonderful book. Like, sketch out the world of Juniper.
Sure. So Juniper is a small town in Scotland, and it once had lots and lots of witch trials hundreds of years ago. And Addy is a modern girl in Juniper. She's autistic. She's 11, and she decides that she can't bear that past and that history, so she campaigns for a memorial for those witches. And it's about her and her time at school, and it's about her older sisters, who are twins, Kidi and Nina. Kidi is autistic like Addy, Nina is not. And Kidi is the prequel. It's set 5 years before A Kind of Spark, and it's about Kidi when she's about to turn 14, and she's growing a little bit apart from Nina, but growing closer to Addy.
Who is her much younger sister?
Yes, Addy is the younger sister.
And one of the things I absolutely loved about Kind of Spark was how you tapped into that thing in kids of thinking that things are their responsibility that can't be, but then can be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like she's trying to fix history. You know, there's something wrong in history and she's trying to fix it. And then she sort of does, which is kind of amazing. I love that. It felt so tender. And in Kidi, I guess Kidi's trying to fix Addy a little bit, or fix the world for Addy. You've just got such an amazing set piece opening where she's basically Errol Flynn as Robin Hood stuck up a tree delivering vengeance and protection for her sister. And it's such a heroic, funny, bold opening, and you fall in love with Keady just the same as you did with Addie, I think.
Oh, thank you, Frank. That's so nice. I love that. Yeah, they're very different personalities. So Addie is not a Pollyanna, but she is very good and very sort of compassionate and understanding, and she sees the best in everyone. And Keady, I think, is way more cynical and way more a little bit more mischievous, and many times in this book as well, thinks that she, like Addie does in A Kind of Spark, Keady thinks that she's doing the right thing, only with Keady she takes it a little bit too far, and I think kind of leaves things a little bit worse than they were. So they're very different in that sense, and it was really quite freeing to write about a teenager that's making lots of mistakes. It was very I mean, true to life, true to my life, but also quite liberating to write about.
That's what I love about it is that... Sorry, Nadia, go on.
Shut your face, Frank. What I was going to ask, but make a note of what you were going to ask, because I just wanted to ask, you talked about, you know, true to your life, Al. I was interested to know kind of what threads, what people, what places, if you're comfortable saying, kind of have similarities with your childhood, or kind of where you grew up, kind of what bits are mirrored.
Yeah, so I am autistic and I am Scottish, so those two things are exactly true, like both Addie and Keady. But I was never socially conscious enough to campaign for any kind of memorial. I do think this generation of children are much more socially aware than mine was, but I think with Keady it's a little bit more autobiographical. I think she makes a lot of the mistakes I made as a teenager in a school which had a lot of cliques, and I think hopefully, this is the terrifying thing, the book hasn't come out yet, I'm hoping that people relate to it or they empathize with it and they don't go, oh my god, this is a terrible way to behave, and it's really exposing. But of course most of the books are fictional and imagined. Keady in a lot of ways is I think the kind of person a lot of teenagers want to be, or they see themselves as. Maybe it's not necessarily so true, but she's very aspirational for a lot of my readers, and I've always loved that about that character. She says things that maybe some of us wish we could say.
But isn't that the joy? That must be such a joy to write, to kind of all the things you wish. Like, it's like that. I don't know if you're anything like me. I like to lie awake until like 3 a.m. thinking about incidents that happened like 20 years ago and replaying them and thinking, what could I have said, or how could I have done this differently? And like, it feels like you must have a lot of fun with that kind of when you write, kind of going back to those times and this is what I would have done, this is the person I would have been.
Absolutely. So Keady's taking on a lot of the bullies at her high school, and which isn't her job and isn't something that her teachers want her to do, and it's something that they really don't like. But there's one scene near the end of the book where she just lets them have it, and she just tells them all these terrible things. And a part of me does, I envy people like that who can speak their mind. I do lie awake at 3 a.m, but I don't rethink horrible things I've said. I rethink things like, oh, when I said thank you, did it sound sarcastic or did it sound genuine? Like, it's really... demonic levels of deconstruction at 3 a.m. But Keady isn't that way. She says quite cutting things, and I know that in reality I wouldn't want to be like that, because it's a very empty feeling afterwards, but it's fun to write. It's really fun to go there.
I mean, is it empty? She's got right on her side, doesn't she? I think that's what, when people write about badass teens or horrible kids, they often forget that kids have a burning sense of joy. I mean, for instance, just William is supposed to be like this terribly badly behaved kid. And there's a lot, I found a lot of William in Keady, which is literally the highest praise I could possibly give. William is always seeking justice. He only wants two things in life. He just wants to be left alone and to deliver justice. He never sets out to do anything bad, does he? You know, and I think... spirit of chivalry is pounding through Kate Keady, I think, you know.
I love that. If there's any of William Brown in any of my characters, that is the biggest compliment. And the thing I love about Just William is it really feels like there's two narratives going on. It feels like when you read it as a child, I remember reading it as a child and thinking, you're right, William, absolutely, this is a great idea, we should be be writing our older brother's girlfriend letters or whatever it is they're doing.
Absolutely should kidnap that child.
Yes, we should absolutely, the outlaws should fight the Huguenots. And then I read it as an adult and I think, oh my God, like, the absolute distance between who he thinks he is and who he is, it's really vast. And I love that about, I love Just William. I think it's so funny. I think Keady would love to run with the Outlaws for a little bit. I hope there's a bit of that. I think Keady sees herself one way and she is completely driven by justice and thinks that she's absolutely right and there's no way to go wrong when you think you're right. And then I think more mature people reading the novel might think, wow, this is a really bold path to take. So yes, that's a huge compliment. I love that.
As well as Just William, what else did you like to read?
I always credit Matilda by Roald Dahl as a big influence on both of these books especially. Mm. I love to read Robin McKinley, fairy tale retellings, and Shannon Hale. And I loved Anne Fine. Anne Fine wrote a book called Charm School. Well, I would memorize it. And I loved it. I loved all the girls' names. They had names like Suki, Serena, and Angelica, and Araminta. They had these fantastic names.
It's funny that you mention names, because that's actually something I've written down here is, you know, you got a real knack for your character names.
I like names that sound quite romantic in the sense that it's not an ordinary name. Mm. And if a character has an ordinary name in the book, it usually means that they're not a favourite.
Yeah.
Which is always, it's always a kick, because then I go to school visits and there's a horrible character called Sophie in this book. And then I meet 50,000 Sophies on school visits and every single one is terrible. So I should give the horrible characters the more obscure names. But I don't want to waste a name. You're going to type a name 55,000 times in a manuscript. It needs to be quite nice, I think. And I do keep a list of names, which if anyone ever found it, they'd think I had some kind of revenge list that I'm crossing off. But it's just names that I find interesting. And when I do school visits, the kids always have their names on post-it notes, as you know. Mm. When they have them signed, their names are on post-it notes, and I just keep all the post-it notes of the names that I like.
Hey, that's clever. That's a good trick.
Yeah. I do that as well.
Do you?
I do that
I might have to borrow that trick, because I get into a right pickle with names.
Do it.
Like, my characters always call things like David Refrigerator. That's the problem. So, you know, I'm not sure that's a great... Actually, I haven't used David Refrigerator, but I'm going to write that down for the next book. David Refrigerator.
Yeah, David Refrigerator is pretty great.
That's a hero's name.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, David Le Refrigerator.
So I met you once, Al. I don't know if you remember. I met you for about 30 seconds
Waterstones.
Once. Waterstones. It was a strange old time, because I think, like, it was still major COVID vibes.
Yeah, it was.
But one thing I remember is that, and I've noticed this... this doesn't sound too creepy. I've noticed this about you, is that you always dress extremely well. So this is a long-winded way of me asking how you came to do the job you now do. Part of me thinks some of it was maybe via fashion.
Well, I used to do fashion writing for this vintage collector. Yeah, I've always loved clothes. I think clothes can tell a story, and I love using them in books to tell a story. In Keady, she wears a big candy floss jacket at one point, and everyone's horrendously embarrassed by it, except her, because she thinks it's great. I mean, I was really lucky. I got to go to Berlin last year for the book festival, and the German person that was walking around with me, the first thing she said was, "I looked on your Instagram. You dressed crazy," and I was like,
wow.
I loved the honesty, and I was like, yep. But I don't know, I just think I think being autistic is sometimes difficult making small talk, and small talk's your big kind of your dragon that you have to always fight. And if you're wearing something a bit odd or a bit different, people comment on it immediately, and it's something to talk about. So it's a kind of armor, I suppose.
You're very in contact with your fans. Part of what you're doing is sort of advocating. So talk about that relationship that you've got with your community.
I hope I write books that all people can enjoy, and not just people who are autistic or neurodiverse. But naturally, a lot of children that are neurodivergent come across them, and there is the case of it. Sometimes it's the first time they've seen someone with their disability in a book, and they become very enthused by it. And also, I think autistic people, if I can generalize, I don't like to generalize, but I think we are very passionate and enthusiastic about the things that we like. So to have a strongly neurodiverse audience means having readers that are very passionate.
A really passionate audience.
Which I love. It's so great. I know I have adult readers that come a lot to events, and they always look annoyed that children are there. I find it really funny. People cut fur off their pets and send it to me.
Oh, I have
a shoebox full of hair. Yeah, it's just a different kind of base, but it's great, and they're so passionate, and they do amazing drawings, they write great letters. So I talk about it a lot, I think, just because it makes me feel less alone, and also to appreciate them, because I think when you're an autistic adult, you know, everyone's got problems as an adult. There's not a whole lot of difference. But when you're a child, that gap is quite large. So a lot of these kids are quite, not lonely, I would say, but they've got their struggles. And so I feel very strongly about making them visible and keeping them in my periphery.
I think it's interesting that you said that in some of your events, you have neurodiverse adults who also attend your events, which maybe tells a story about the lack of traditionally published books which have neurodivergent main characters. And that's something that you've spoken about a lot. And in fact, I know that you set up a prize.
Yeah. When the Blue Peter Book Award sadly was disbanded, the thing I was sad about was the Blue Peter Book Award, the children vote for the winner. You know, Watterson's was an amazing prize to win, and it's voted for by booksellers, but I love prizes where the children have the voice. And so I said, oh, I might do something just with schools to get kids voting for their favourite book again. And it was never, ever intended to be anything remotely holding itself up as any kind of big deal. It was just going to be one of these small schools. Because as you both know, schools do lots of great prizes. And they don't get written about in national newspapers, but they are, I think, more important because they empower the kids and the community to vote for what they like most. And I love reading the judges' notes from the children. So they're currently on their shortlist right now. They're still fighting it out, and I just love the notes, because judging awards as an adult I love as well, but our notes are always very, very intellectual, and we're really picking it, and the kids are just like, didn't like this one, next. They don't care who the author is, they don't care how many awards that author has, they just want to, they just, if they, it's whether they like it or not. And so it's called the Adrian Prize, named after my friend who was disabled. The only rules are the protagonist has to have a disability of some kind in the social model, and they're not allowed to die. So they're not allowed to be dead by the end of the book. And actually, we've had some really great submissions this year and last year. Publishing's getting really, really, really good at disability now.
Oh, really? Have you noticed a change?
Yeah. Mostly in understanding that children don't want books that are like vegetables being pushed in their mouth, trying to educate them about, they just want to read great stories. And we're trying to showcase and highlight great stories that happen to have disability in them, where that's not the entire plot.
It's a really important and massive distinction, isn't it? I know from conversations or seeing publishing over the last 10 years and conversations about inclusion or diversity, whether that's, you know, race, sexuality or neurodiversity. This is the frustration. It's like, it's got to be a good book. It's got to be story first.
Yeah.
It's got to be funny or exciting or scary or whatever. It's got to be those
things. It can't just be trauma. And I think with disability, there was just so, it's quite easy to lean into trauma. And that's not always the most interesting thing to read about. It has its place. You know, every book has its place. It can't all just be one type of narrative. But the aim of this small prize is just to shine a light on authors who are telling these stories without relying on shock value.
But okay, so it's really interesting that there is a rule that they're not allowed to die. Why do you want to go into detail about why they're not allowed to die?
Yeah, I mean,
and why that came onto your agenda as well, actually.
I think because when I was younger, one of the great disability reps I think about when I was young was Hilary Mackay with Sarah in Safi's Angel. He was a great character.
Oh, yeah.
He just happened to be in a wheelchair. But a lot of the stories were the sort of Smike from Nicholas Nickleby treatment, where it was a pitiful character and everyone feels very sorry for them. And it's usually also never the protagonist. And I just think it's a trope that we see regularly with disability, where the character dies. And there's been a lot of, you know, Mice and Men kind of retellings with Lenny and George. I just felt like I'd read it so many times. And those stories can still be published. That's totally great. I just would love our prize to shine a light on the ones where the disabled person lives, because that feels like a hopeful, especially in children's literature, a hopeful message rather than a sad, scary one.
I couldn't agree more, because it's about kind of using the whole palette, isn't it? It's like, yes, these stories should be everything. There should be joyful stories and scary stories and terrifying stories and all the rest.
And sometimes it's really tricky. And I might have to get rid of the rule eventually once we've done a few years, because I was reading a YA entry this year, which was amazing. Mm. And the character does die because they then become a ghost and that's the plot. And I thought, is that kind of a marriage?
That's very good.
And so I think we will get rid of the rule eventually. Yeah, it's just the Tiny Tim treatment we don't need so much of. But you never say never. I will probably get less crotchety about it the older I get.
Well, no, but it's progress. And sometimes it's necessary to kind of lay down a law until people get up to speed. And then things hopefully evolve. And and we've got a healthier landscape.
Agreed. I'm sorry to bring this very serious topic to the island. But...
Don't be sorry. I'm enjoying it, and it's a break from Frank wittering on about whatever he's banging on about.
So you've had this very positive experience of filming A Kind of Spark. Does it make you want to do it again?
I'd love to do it again. We do have season 2 on the way. I can't say when.
So would season 2 be a prequel? Would it be Keedy?
Season 2 is picking up directly where season 1 ended, and it's all brand new storylines that are new to readers and to TV audience, because now there's two camps in A Kind of Spark. There's people who've read the book and there's people who've watched the show. And the book audience, I think, have been quite smug up till now because they always know what's coming, and now everyone's on the same page. Nobody knows what's coming. It's all brand new. I did a school visit this morning and a child said, did they teach you to write scripts? I said, no, they threw me into the deep end.
Oh my goodness.
But it's okay.
Oh, have you got any good school visit stories?
I mean, I've got a million. There was one school visit I did in Muswell Hill, and this teacher, after it was over, said, oh, this is, I can't remember the child's name, but let's say Craig. He said, this is Craig. Craig really likes geography. Do you want to take Craig on a geography quiz? And I said, no, thank you. But they were like, go on. And I said, okay. When I say this kid was like, had a PhD in geography, aged 11, and it was so embarrassing. Craig wiped the floor with me.
I can absolutely top that. I did an event in Blackpool for the Wonder Brothers. And because the Wonder Brothers is about magic, I felt obliged to learn a small repertoire of relatively impressive magic tricks. But it is nerve-wracking, because if a magic trick goes wrong, you can't back out of it. Mm. You know, you just look like an idiot. And they're all paying attention the way they're not when you're reading. People watch a magic trick waiting for you to fail. You know, it's like watching Formula One. You watch Formula One because you want someone to die. And you watch magic because... But it's true, isn't it? You're waiting for a crash.
No, it's not.
You're waiting for a crash.
Maybe. Oh, isn't it?
Okay. I don't watch Formula One. But you watch magic hoping that someone's going to drop the cards.
Yeah.
And I thought, right, I'm not going to. I've simplified all these. I've got it worked out. I'm not going to drop a card. And I asked for a volunteer, and a girl stood up. And as she walked to the front, everybody started laughing. Started my trek. They were just like in fits laughing. And I said, do you know why they're laughing? And she went, yeah, because I've just won Britain's Got Talent doing a magic act.
<It's> like... No.
So I had to go through it, my crappy little ambitious card routine with this girl who'd made Simon, what's his name, vanish.
What an absolute stitch up. Did she
shame
you, or did she kind of indulgently smile at you?
Actually, do you know, it was really beautiful because to start the trick, I had to do like a false shuffle where you make it look as though you're shuffling the cards, but you know where they are. And I was shuffling very badly, and she went, I'll shuffle them for you. And I thought,
oh.
And she took the cards off me and she shuffled them. But she false shuffled. She knew what I was trying to do, and she false shuffled. Wasn't that beautiful?
Oh,
and
I
she
guess.
Passed me back the
Is
cards.
That a nice thing?
With a little wink. Okay. Yeah, because I could carry on with it. She knew exactly what I was trying to do. Yeah,
she knew what you were trying to do.
And she sort of winked at me. So she made me She made me look good.
That's heartwarming.
Yeah.
Wow.
Elle, are you doing, how do you feel about festivals? Are you appearing at any this year that you're allowed to tell us about? Or?
But the answer is yes. Possibly. Me and my shark will be on
You and your
on
shark.
Tour.
Does your shark have a name, by the way?
Bull.
David Radiator. Why not?
I love that. David Radiator, the Mako.
Yeah. Speaking of which, the Mako's thrashing around, looking impatient. Yeah. But before we say goodbye to you, Al, do you
We've been very polite about this for the last hour. Where are the snacks?
Oh, yes. We totally forgot to get snacks off you. Oh, my days. Yeah.
I didn't forget. I've just been waiting.
Oh, I forgot completely.
For it to happen. I'm holding a Frisbee and hoping someone's going to put snacks in it.
Okay, I'm opening this bag and pouring these Palm Bear crisps into the Frisbee.
Yes.
They are the most flavorless crisps, and yet they hit the spot.
They're like matter. I've had those before. Yeah.
And if you turn them upside down, they're rabbits. They go from bears to rabbits.
And that's magic.
They're very pleasing.
All about perspective.
I mean, she's a fantastic writer, but Catherine Rundle came to the island and bought a bag of apples.
Oh, dear.
We're still not over that, to be honest. That was
back to the rooftop she go.
That was a dark, dark day when she bought her bag of apples. Can I ask, Elle, do you have any books to keep us busy while we are stuck on this island? Oh,
yes, I do. The second Vivi Conway book by Lizzie Huxley-Jones is out in May, but it's all Welsh mythology, Arthurian legend, adventures, a magic sword, and a ghost dog. And
oh my gosh.
Excellent fun. I'm just about to start Greenwild.
Ah, yes.
All right. Greenwild is a great show.
And I'm going to reread the Girls series by Jacqueline Wilson because she's just announced that she's going to write an adult version or an adult book about where the girls are now. And the joy I felt upon reading that announcement, because I grew up reading the Girls series by Jacqueline Wilson, I was like, this is fantastic. And then it said, as the girls turn 40 and the smile slips off my face and the laughter died. And I thought, wow, the time really comes at you fast.
That's brutal.
Yeah, but I'm excited, so I'm going to reread that by Jacqueline Wilson.
Well, that's excellent, and if you can leave any of those for us here before you get back on the chart, that would be much appreciated. Elle, it's been an absolute delight. I'm so excited to see Keedy fly, which I know it's going to do.
Thank you for having me on the island, and I'm sorry about the shark and all of the carnage.
Fran, do you want to help? Can you help maybe get Elle out on the shot?
Well,
you need to.
She maybe doesn't need to. Do you need to go back on the shot? Because I've noticed this, like, this the time of the day, there's like a cloud forming on the beach, a bit of sea fret, and that cloud's got like number 9 written on the side. So that is cloud 9. And I think post your RTS award.
Of course.
That's how everybody leaves an RTS award, if they've got a little trophy
on
in their hand.
Cloud 9.
They go out.
All right, we'll look after David Radiator, Elle. You can go up on cloud.
You
can go up on cloud.
So RTS award-winning Elle McNichol, float on, float on.
Bye.
Bye, Elle.
Bye. Float on. Oh, look what's gleaming on the beach now that the cloud has lifted, Nadia. Do you recognise that?
I'm hoping it's my other Frisbee.
No, it's not your Frisbee.
Okay.
It's not your Frisbee.
Okay, chill.
It's a lovely, lovely, lovely shiny shell. That shell looks very convenient to me. Should we listen to our convenient shell?
It's Emily Drabble's convenient shell. Come on.
What's the word from over the sea in the land of Book Trust about what to read next?
Well, hello, Nadia and Frank. So I'm starting with The Magic Callaloo, a wonderful retelling of Rapunzel by master storyteller Trish Cook. She famously wrote the classic picture book, So Much, and Sophie Bass, published by Walker. This version is inspired by stories Trish Cook heard about Africans who made patterns in their corn-rowed hair and used them as maps to escape from their enslavers. So in this tale, our Rapunzel is lovely Lou, the beloved child born from a wish given by a leaf on a magical callaloo plant. That plant had been stolen from the village by a wicked man who has used up most of the wishes to make himself richer than rich. But Lou's parents, they so long for a child, they broke through the barbed wire of the man's house to reach the plant, and they used the very last leaf for the wish. So their child Lou is full of joyful songs, and she has the most incredibly luscious afro curly locks that seem to reach out to the sun. They look a bit like the branches of a callaloo plant. The wicked man finds Lou and steals her away. So read the book to find out what happens. but this is certainly a gorgeous book and it's a profound retelling. The illustrations by Sophie Bass are something to behold indeed. They're so vibrant. They fill your head with colour, light and love, and they make the story so magical. This is now my favourite version of Rapunzel. And now another story of liberation in Kim Hilliard's Frida, the Rock and Roll Moth. Frida is a moth that plays a purple guitar in the shed and she plays it loud. Her biggest fan is Auntie Edna, but she gets lonely in the shed with nobody much else to rock with until the owner of the shed turns on the light. Then all manner of moths flock in, playing all kinds of songs, but they seem more sparkly than Frida. She decides to change herself to be like them, but she finds herself too shy to join in. Luckily, Auntie Edna is there to remind her to be herself, and that is Frida the Rock and Roll Moth, loud and proud. It feels like a particularly lovely book to read with children when they're about to start school, when it can be hard to be yourself, or a new nursery. Now, Frida is a hero. Kim Hilliard's illustrations perfectly capture the emotion of it all. Oh, it's just such a lovely book, so do read it. Now on to a couple of books I've read as part of the Branford Bowes long list. Starting with Dee Benson's debut, Glow Up, Lara Bloom, The Secret Diary of a Teenage Catastrophe. Now, lots of books aimed at young teenage girls describe themselves as great for fans of the late, great Louise Renison, who wrote the Confessions of Georgia Nicholson series. But this book is the nearest to it for me. It's genuinely hilarious, and the tremendous personality of Liverpudlian Lara just jumps off the page. Her obsessions are so spot on and relatable. For example, could glamorous Londoner Caden fancy a girl so into playing football? Why has her afro gone so puffy? Can Mum stop giving her useless advice? Could Naomi Campbell please adopt her? In a way, it's a bit like the picture book I've just talked about, Frida the Rock and Roll Moth. So it's a great tale about how to be yourself and how challenging this can be. It all adds up to a pitch-perfect, brilliant read. Very, very well-written book. Another really funny book is Lise Jardine's The Detention Detectives. This book cracked me up. It's hilarious, and I know 10-year-olds will love it. The story starts when new boy Jono and Daniel find their PE teacher, Mr. Bainton, dead in the trunk in the sports equipment shed, murdered. The police detective shows up and asks, was he an unpleasant piece of work? A lot of my PE teachers were. And it turns out he was fairly unpleasant, and a lot of people had reasons to want him out of the picture. The police aren't much cop, so Jono, Daniel and Lydia, who were not previously friends, end up forming a kind of reluctant detective trio. The prime suspect is Lois, who was married to Mr. Bainton, but she's also Daniel's mum's carer, so things get really complicated. The whole book is perfectly paced and tight, no flabby writing at all, really funny, 4 marks. And finally, a beautiful board book by Smriti Halls. It's illustrated by Marta Altes, called Guess Who's Going to Sleep. Now, babies and toddlers should really get the best books and we should care deeply about them and talk about them more, I think, because it's the first books. This one is a cracker. It's a lift the flap book with wonderful magical optical illusions. So who's that yawning under the tree? It looks like a bird, but lift the flap, it's actually a bee. It's genius the way the pictures and illusions are so gorgeous and kind of exciting, but the colour palette makes you feel a bit dreamy and it's a bit twilighty, so you can sleep after it. Important for this kind of book. It's a gorgeous book and you take a peek at who else is going to sleep in the mirror at the end, so really nice to help a little baby get to sleep. So I'll get all these books over to you on the island by hot air balloon. Happy reading, all.
Thank you so much, Emily Drabble of BookTrust, for your fab recommendations. I particularly am looking forward to getting my teeth into Frida the Rock and Roll Moth because I love Kim Hilliard. I think she's a real talent. You aware of her work, Frank?
I'm not aware of her work, and I'm absolutely riveted by the idea of a rock and roll moth. I want to know more. I want to know more about that. That's the best title I've heard in some time.
Well, here, you can take that one away with you. Now, what was I doing? I was drinking coffee, wasn't I? And you were not.
You're making life hard for me.
I was making boiled water. Yeah. All right. Well, look, I'm not going to torture you any longer. I might just have a coconut juice and take myself off to my hammock, I think, and have a
read.
I'm going to pretend to read, but I think really I'm going to snooze.
And I'm going to do something very similar, because without caffeine and without tannin, I can barely stay awake, as you can tell. I may not even make it back to the hammock. I might just drop here.
Well, I'll just leave you there.
The lovely tones, the dulcet tones of the ukulele off.
Trio, say trio. He almost had it, listeners. I'm going to leave him face down in the sand as punishment as the ukulele off trio play us out. Thank you to amazing producer Jeff Bird. Thank you to the ukulele off trio. Thank you, Elle McNichol. No thanks to you, Frank Cottrell Boyce.
And thank you, Emily Drabble.
Which I've already said.